We're delighted to be with Christopher Dickey, who has written Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD, and lots of other things. You've been working with Newsweek for many years. You have gone all over the world thinking about, looking, reporting on, helping us think about terrorism in a wider scale and lots of other issues. Bill, you were saying granularity and context, which sounds pretty removed from this blockbuster story you're telling.
Well, it's all about people. I mean, the key to fighting terrorism is to have a lot of very good human intelligence. Human intelligence, human intelligence, human intelligence is sort of like location, location, location.
Yeah. Yep.
That's where you have to focus your resources. Now, how do you get good human intelligence? Do you waterboard people? Do you torture them? Do you put them in Abu Ghraib? Do you put them in Guantanamo? Sometimes that might give you some. Sometimes that might give you some intelligence, but it's often going to be very unreliable intelligence.
And it's very illegal.
Well, there's that.
And is it immoral?
Well, there's that.
But
let's not be picky about these things.
It's counterproductive.
Let's just talk about the functionality of it. What you really want to do, if you're going to have really effective human intelligence, you've got to be penetrating organizations. You've got to be liaising with communities. You've got to be working with people. And what is so striking about the NYPD is the way they took the diversity of New York, which I think a lot of people in the United States would look at and say, what a nightmare. 40% of the population of New York City was not born in the United States of America. You know, that's like, oh, they're not from around here, are they? And they take that and they make it work for them, because the NYPD is a great entry-level position. Police have always been entry-level positions, police jobs, for immigrants, whether they were Irish or Italian or German or Polish, for more than a century. So that's still true. And what they did, one of the first things they did when Kelly came back in and brought in Cohen, was to say, I wonder how many people we've got on the force already who speak foreign languages. And they asked for volunteers. Tell them, do you speak a foreign language? And of course, they're not going to just take their word for it. They test them, send them off to Berlitz to be tested. And they came back with about 700 people in the NYPD who spoke languages directly relevant to the fight against terrorism.
Things like?
Spoke them as native languages. Arabic in many dialects. Persian. Dari. Pashtun.
Urdu.
Bengali. You name it. They had it.
And Urdu, Farsi.
Yeah, Persian. Yeah, exactly. They had all these, not linguists. This is an important distinction. Not translators. They had all these cops who spoke these languages as their native language.
In startling contrast to the CIA and the FBI.
And the FBI and the State Department. In stunning contrast to any federal government job that requires a high-level security clearance, and most of those do. If you want to be an FBI agent, if you want to be a CIA operative, you have to get those high-level clearances, which means going through a process that basically dates to the Cold War. A good friend of mine is in military intelligence, very close friend, and you know, he says, look, the security clearance process is insane. You know, if you were born outside the country, they can't do a background check on you. Let's say you were born in Karachi. You know the back streets of Karachi. Now, that's exactly the kind of person you want in your intelligence business, right? But how are the guys doing the background check going to go knock on the door of people in Karachi? Gee, did you know this guy when he was in the madrasa when he was 6 years old? You think he was a radical? No, you can't do that. You can't. Functionally, you can't do it. Which means none of those guys from Karachi are ever going to be FBI agents or CIA agents.
It's a tremendous loss.
It is a tremendous loss, but not a loss to the NYPD, which is just the point. The NYPD says, look, we'll polygraph these guys, we'll do background checks on them, we'll obviously keep an eye on them, but we'll work with them and we'll bring them into the system.
And they've already been vetted to be cops.
But that's not like, as any one of the feds will tell you, it's not like being vetted to be a FBI agent.
One of the three-letter guys.
One of the three-letter guys, exactly. which is what the NYPD calls the all the. It is funny, you know, when they said that to me the first time, three letter guys. I was like, oh yeah, they're all three: CIA, FBI, DEA, ICE. It's all three letter guys.
White House.
Yeah, White House.
Well. Well, National Security Council.
Yeah, NSC. Yeah. So that made a huge difference that they didn't have to vet these guys in that federal government process. And so they had all of a sudden all these resources to do what with them? Some of them work the web in the intelligence division. They work the chat rooms. So, and you know, there are filters that the bad guys will use in the chat rooms where they'll say, you know, I just went by that mosque that was torn down last week last year in Karachi. And that's if you don't know that that mosque is actually still standing in Karachi, you're not going to get to the next level in that chat room. But since the NYPD's guys do know that, they can say, what the heck, what are you talking about? So,
because they were just back for the wedding.
Because they were just back for the wedding. Well, actually, that was a classic case. When I was doing one of the chapters in the book, is a narrative of the sort of last days before New Year's Eve 2007, when Benazir Bhutto has been murdered. And there's a question of how the police are going to react to this. Now, The police in New York. And the NYPD does have people stationed in a lot of places, but they don't have any stationed in Pakistan. I asked them about that, and they said, well, you know, it worked out okay because one of our guys from the counterterrorism division was back there for a family wedding anyway. So it's that kind of intimacy which is the key to the intelligence gathering in the NYPD and the key to its eventual ability to, as Cohen likes to say, trade intelligence, not share intelligence. He says there's no such thing as sharing intelligence, only trading.
Which New Yorkers are probably pretty good at.
Yeah, New Yorkers are probably pretty good at. And the federal government is really not used to from a local police force.
They don't understand that. This is almost parenthetical, but you quote somebody early on saying that, you know, talking about interrogation techniques and enhanced so-called interrogation techniques. Quote somebody as saying, if you can get the subject laughing with you,
sure,
you will get a statement every time. Which is, I mean, there are a lot of things in this book that are counterintuitive. That one's high on the list. And it tells us a great deal about the kinds of human intelligence you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was before the Age of Terror. That was Jack Maple, who was one of the men responsible, really, for the radical changes in crime fighting that took place in the NYPD in the early and mid-1990s when Kelly was out of the picture. And Maple, you know, was a real straight shooter. And he says, it's all about building complicity, building rapport with the subject. He said, you know, if you can make them laugh, that's the key. But he said, I'll get down on my knees and pray to God with the subject. If he'll talk to me, if he'll give it to me, if he'll give up what I want him to give up. And most people want to talk. The idea that these hardened terrorists don't want to talk? Nah. It's fascinating. And, you know, in the book, there's a lot of sort of history of terrorism. And I wanted, since I was writing this, to put together pieces that I hadn't seen anybody else put together before. And I was very interested in why Al-Qaeda failed in its attempt to have a second wave of attacks, which it certainly had wanted to do. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 9/11, had wanted these second waves to take place. And it was in the effort to stop that we had all this waterboarding going on at the black sites. And it's amazing how much the waterboarders did not understand about the people they were waterboarding. Even if we just take it as a given that they only did the three that they've admitted to doing. Abu Zubaydah, the first one they caught, was a sort of a concierge at the Al-Qaeda hotel. He saw himself as a poet, and he was a very kind of, had a flighty kind of imagination. He was not the smartest guy in the world. And he spoke in this kind of poetical way. And they didn't start to get anything from him, really, until they started to relate to those kinds of aspects of his personality. You know, the CIA tells the story, yeah, we waterboard him and he talked instantly. That's crap. And by the time you get to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which was a year later, in 2003, you know, they had all the stuff they needed to interrogate him without waterboarding. And furthermore, he's probably the most talkative person this side of Jay Leno. I mean, the guy loves to talk. Anytime he talked to a reporter, which was a couple of times, just blah, blah, he claimed everything. And of course, eventually in his confession, he claimed everything except the crucifixion of Christ. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you didn't have to waterboard this guy. He was waterboarded just because they wanted to waterboard
him. That one was revenge, you said.
Vengeance.
Revenge.
Yeah. We're going to be back in a minute with Christopher Dickey so that we can continue this without me interrupting you. Mr. Dickey, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, be with us. We'll be right back.